Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disabilities who have taken from them or are denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those above them. Disrespect welcomes from New Orleans Wade Rathke, the chief organizer of Acorn International and the author of a book he's going to tell us about called Citizen Wealth, Winning the Campaign to Save Working Families. Wade, welcome to the show.
Oh, delighted to be with you, Jeff.
Now, my listeners, I don't know if my listener knows much about Citizen Wealth. I don't know much about Citizen Wealth except very briefly what I've read summarizing the book. But I gather from talking with you that the focus of the book is about the disenfranchisement of low- and middle-income people.
Exactly right, and you're certainly not behind. It's just coming into bookstores now as of the first part of July, so
All right.
Sure, couldn't be in better stead in terms of getting this book out to people. I'm delighted for the opportunity, but that's exactly right. The book is called Citizen Wealth, Winning the Campaign to Save Working Families,
and All right.
It goes through chapter after chapter of strategies for how families can achieve, through organizational and collective action mainly, some level of income security.
Right. Well, income security is a problem for anyone on a limited income, especially beholden to anybody else. And these days, more working people are beholden to somebody else for their income than their employers. Your publisher makes a claim that the book draws on lessons learned from 40 years in the field. I gather it's something of an organizing handbook, too.
Well, it'd be wonderful if, that would be a dream come true if people grabbed the book and then figured, hey, you know, this is a good idea, I'm going to go do that. And I'll be honest with you, I actually call for people to look at some of the simple things that many of us as citizens or local organizations or people active in churches or unions or nonprofits could do to help make sure that eligible families get full participation in any kind of benefit or other program that's already been approved.
It's funny that you would say that, because I've even had financial advisors who have run out of people feeling fat and happy to advise, or maybe never were interested in helping them in the first place. I've had them come to me and ask, are you willing to air a show about the benefits that people of limited means are entitled to and don't know about and aren't claiming?
Well, that's exactly, you're hitting the head on the nail on the head, because over the number of years, an effort that we've been involved in pushing is trying to make sure, even if Parliament or provincial governments or anybody else didn't lift a finger, there's still benefits that people are eligible for they're not getting. I mean, look at the problems now with unemployment insurance or E1 programs in Canada. These are programs that are expressly designed to serve working families when they run into a problem at the job, where the job isn't there even though they're ready to go. And yet people are being denied these benefits. The participation in the United States sometimes in some states is as low as 50 to 50-60%. And even in Canada, talking to some of my friends with Acorn Canada, there are some provinces where it can be as low as 70% participation.
Yeah. No, don't be embarrassed. I know you're in New Orleans. It's a long way from Canada. And I know we had a Canadian migration there, but it was a few hundred years ago.
Yeah.
What the program is called here now is employment insurance. which is a kind of newspeak, and it's abbreviated EI, employment insurance. But unemployment insurance is what people who are older know it as, and we still wonder what its purpose is, despite the fact it has a new name. It makes a lot of money for the government. Not far from all that money goes back to people who are unemployed.
Well, and that's what, frankly, I don't get. And I think it's a real opportunity for organizations, organizers, and individuals to do something about Jeff. Is, you know, with all the modern technology, in many cases, it's not that difficult to make it possible for people to apply for those benefits right through computers.
Oh.
It's possible to do that through taxes. It's possible to do that with some other programs.
Right.
For all the high-tech talk, why have we not done what's necessary to make, I'm not saying put a computer necessarily in every family's home. That's probably not something they're willing to do under the Harper government. But at least put them in kiosks, put them in community centers, put them in libraries.
They are in libraries. Every library now in the major municipal centers, and probably in a lot of the little ones, has internet access. And anybody anybody from the community can come in.
Get their benefits through that.
Yeah, yeah. It makes a lot of sense. And in the States, this hasn't been done.
Not yet and not enough.
Probably a good description of Canada, too.
As long as we have, you know, anybody who's eligible and who's not getting the benefits or has been discouraged from getting the benefits, we've got a problem. But the other issue that I spend a lot of time on in this book is one of the signal accomplishments of community organizations in these states over the last, you know, 30 or more years has been the passage of something called the Community Reinvestment Act, which made it possible for working families, lower-income families, regardless of ethnicity or race or anything else, to purchase a home in many communities throughout the country. I've always been surprised in working with Acorn Canada that there's not a similar Community Reinvestment Act in Canada that tracks where people are making their deposits and discloses whether or not a proportional amount of loans is made in those same communities. We called that redlining when we were fighting this over the years here in the States.
Oh, basically you're poor so you don't deserve a loan?
Well, that's right. I mean, what we discovered once the there was a Federal Home Mortgage Loan Disclosure Act that was passed is in many cases deposits were being taken out of lower income and working communities, the Scarboroughs, if you will, or other neighborhoods, New Westminster's or whatever, and a Canadian equivalent, yet weren't being loaned back there. Instead, they were being loaned to people buying condos or, you know, big houses in the suburbs or wherever else. And that ended up being a disinvestment in the communities because you were essentially putting your money aside with a bank, be it Dominion, you know, Toronto Dominion or, you know, whoever else, Scotia Bank, and you weren't seeing it come back into your neighborhood. So that's something in Canada we really need to take a look at is how to put the information in front of people and make sure that there's not redlining going on in communities in Canada so that people have an opportunity. Because in some cases, getting the ability to buy your apartment or co-op or home is one of the huge things that can create income security over years for a family.
Yeah, and your book discusses this, how to attack this question, how to identify redlining and how to deal with it?
Exactly right, as well as looks at some of the huge difference that's made in income transfers from into low-income communities of what their own asset building has been. What their own asset building.
So they're basically deprived of the tools for asset building.
Exactly.
Yeah.
As long as right now one of the big programs that actually is set up to deal with income security, and this is certainly true in the States, and you'll have to tell me in Canada, but here on income tax, there's an income tax deduction for interest paid on home mortgages.
No, can't do that here.
Well, God love you then, but because what that means is in the name of supposedly helping lower-income and working families, that's a huge benefit that's largely passed on indiscriminately regardless of income. If we could get a fair taxation system, there's a whole lot of things we could do with the money being given there for, frankly, people that don't need it. But, yeah, you're ahead of us there. We may be ahead of you on CRA, but you could teach us something about the tax system.
Well, Canadians don't look well and I'm not sure of the economics. I haven't taken a close look at it, but they don't look well upon tax deductibility for mortgage interest. But I don't see any reason why it couldn't be provided for from a means test, you know, for certain groups, certain income groups.
If we could get some disclosure so we knew what was really happening in the lending markets from deposits to loans.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm arguing about citizen wealth. Some of this, you don't have to be a big fancy PhD economist or a member of parliament to figure out. You need common sense and the ability to talk to your neighbors and figure out, hey, what can we do ourselves to make sure everybody gets what they have coming to them? These are rights, for goodness sakes. And I think a lot of average citizens, whether in the United States or Canada, don't really realize that people are being systematically denied their rights.
I think there's also an attitude, and maybe it's just unique to me, but my feeling is that anybody can end up disadvantaged. All it takes is if you're middle class, all it takes is the loss of a couple of paychecks and you're suddenly scrambling. Even if you pull down a good income, if you don't have most of it invested and you become disabled, you're going to be scrambling too. And people don't realize that these programs that we've fought for disadvantaged people are open to anybody when they become disadvantaged. You know, the people who are taking advantage of those programs now are placeholders for the people yet to come. And I don't think they see that.
That's exactly right. I've spent years working with Canadian auto workers. They were a great help to us down here in New Orleans, and I've worked with them in Canada as well as steel workers and other unions. And to see the continued deindustrialization is exactly your point. People are losing great jobs that provide middle income and better wages as we continue to shrink our industrial base in Canada every time you know it. And certainly around Hamilton, I know that's been a huge issue for the last couple of decades.
Oh, yeah. We have land quite deep all around the lake that's covered in industrial buildings dating back almost to the early 1900s, some of them. And the question is what to do with them because of the tremendous remediation costs to change the land use. And the lands are often designated for business and industrial use, but then somebody comes along with a wad of money, says, oh, well, we'll remediate it. Whether they do or not, I don't know. And then the employment land is given up, and along with it, the employment, or the potential employment, even if the building's underutilized now. I mean, it's there. The land is there. You know, the people are there. If you give it away, you know, it can't come back.
It's a vicious cycle. We're very excited at the work that Acorn Canada has been doing here in Hamilton throughout this year. They're assisting several communities to build new organizations and get involved in some of these issues. And I'm looking forward next time I'm in Canada to going down and visiting some of the leaders and James Wardlaw, who's the director of the program there. But we're all in the same program, I think, here because, I mean, this is what citizen wealth is how to look at a holistic way of what benefits everybody in the community and not just one piece or another. And we could have never stopped this book. I could have added chapters like you're talking about and deindustrialization and everything else. We're trying to get people interested and take a look at how easy it is to really act collectively and do something.
We'll take a short break with Kenny Blues Boss Wayne. Don't be mad.
Playing blues all night. Don't be sad with me, baby, long as I treat you right. 'Cause I know there's no man alive that loves you like I do. Don't be mad with me, baby, 'cause I play the blues. I've been playing all of my life. It soothes my soul. I've been playing all of my life, sometimes out in the cold. No one ever told me someday I'll have to choose. Don't be mad with me, baby, 'cause I chose the blues. Oh, woman, don't be mad I get home real late. Don't be sad, pretty baby, if I made you wait. You see, me and my friend, there are things we like to do. Sit around and drink and talk, play the blues.
You've been listening to author and Acorn International organizer Wade Rafke talk about his new book for low and middle income people on income security called Citizen Wealth. The publisher's blurb also calls your book a hard-hitting, comprehensive grassroots strategy to create citizen wealth, an enduring foundation on which working people can build a future that extends beyond paying next month's rent. We're undergoing supposedly a poverty review this year in Ontario, and a review of disability benefits, which is necessarily a kind of poverty review too. And I'm hoping that it comes up with some kind of view of poverty as more, rather than a lack of income, a lack of income security, and that they acquire a broader understanding of the problem. It really doesn't, this isn't true literally, but it matters less what your income is than how dependable it is and what you can do with it. You know, if you get a lot of money this month and you don't know what you're getting next month, it's not a lot of use. If you're getting a steady income, you know, this month, next month, the month after, you can make plans.
Well, that's exactly right. I don't want to get too technical here because I want as many people as are listening to your show to pick up this book and read it. But, you know, the truth is exactly what you're talking about. There's a difference between income and assets or wealth.
Yeah.
Just a simple, I think all of us who have a job know that just getting a raise of 5 or 6% may look good on paper or good in a union contract, but then we can hardly find it in our check. So there can't be a program that just looks at marginal increases in income. There have to be programs when we're really talking about what makes a difference in creating citizen wealth or poverty reduction, mm-hmm. and how to create assets, mm-hmm. how to make it possible for people to make more money in those jobs through educational support, how we make it possible for people to own decent and affordable housing, how we reduce transport, you know, all these things, you know, do exactly what you're talking about, is let us make it past those crises where we're you lose a couple of paychecks or get laid off or a job and you're out virtually homeless. I mean, we need to really look at what makes people secure.
Does your book deal with sort of a future, or put it this way, programs that are on the table that can be that might go either way, that might be might become realities or might fail for lack of popular support, and how to support them? And does it deal with how to put forward new programs?
Well, you know, the answer is yes and no. I really tried to focus on to not make this just a policy book, because unfortunately a lot of the people I want to read this book, if you say the word policy, you can almost hear them yawn over the phone.
Yep.
So what I really looked at was at the, you know, what I would call the low-hanging fruit.
Okay.
What we could do to have a huge difference even if we didn't get anything new passed.
All right.
So at that level, it talks about that. And then
I think that's
we
important.
Also talked at length about how to deal with living wage programs and community reinvestment and those kind of things. And, yeah, you're right, Jeff, that does kind of sneak in the issue that, yeah, I believe that we need to have a, in Canada's a good example, we need a Community Reinvestment Act in Canada. And look at, there's no federal, there's no national minimum wage in Canada.
No.
You know, we're about to have a minimum wage increase in the U.S., and when that happens in terms of, you know, comparable buying power,
yeah,
the United States minimum wage will be higher than the Maritime Provinces and British Columbia and two other provinces in Canada.
Wow.
Not to see that.
Yeah.
I always think of Canada, at least, as doing things a little bit righter than we do down here.
Well, it must look that way when you come up here to go camping or holiday in the Muskokas. But no, in the cities, the government has been implementing programs to discourage unemployment, which essentially underfund it and make it impossible for people to hold on to the assets that would support their return to the workforce. And we're seeing it in increased people on the streets, increased homelessness, increased medical costs, and we're flicking the switch, but we don't know if the light's yet gone on.
Well, that's a good line, and I'm going to remember that one.
Yeah, well, sometimes you got to build a fire.
Well, I mean, yes, indeed. But this is really a global problem. I actually had the opportunity to go work with some organizations and individuals in Sicily recently, and they wanted to show me this huge housing development in the city of Catania. 60,000 families lived there at the time it was built in the early 70s. It was a model, you know, famous Tokyo architect.
Right.
But what was happening is all the social housing, the public housing, was being abandoned by the city. And, you know, they first thought maybe this was a mafia or something like that. But the more I looked at it, the clearer it became. This is just standard what we see, whether it's in any big city in the U.S. or Canada. It was a decision by the local government that it was easier for them to tear this down and build something new that went to market price and provide, you know, decent and safe housing for people in public accommodation.
That's what's happening in Hamilton.
And that's just that. I wanted to say crime, but you know, shame, crime, it's a pity. We really can't keep doing that.
I resigned yesterday from the from a housing wait list. I long ago left Hamilton's behind when they refused to acknowledge my health needs in public housing. But I resigned from public housing in Toronto. I told them, basically, I said, please take my name off the wait list. I don't need to come here, you know, to your office and be humiliated and wait decades for beat up housing. You know, it just there's no percentage in this for anybody, not for you, not for me, you know. So you have 17,000 or 20,000 people on your waiting list. Now you have one less, you know. I'm happy, you're happy sort of thing, you know. Now go away. I just, I don't understand the neglect of public housing or why it isn't turned over to a different model. We had it about 1998, I guess, we had public housing turned over from the provinces to the cities, which was clearly an untenable move because it was those buildings date back to the 60s and require a lot of upkeep. But the we haven't got beyond saying it's not the city's fault. You know, we haven't got the money, it's not the city's fault, and gone to a new model to support public housing.
Well, and that's this unfunded mandate problem, and that's just like the Sicily housing was built in 1972. I mean, you talk about housing that's, you know, darn close to 40 years old. Hell, you know, we know when we get 40 ourselves, we need more maintenance. We need to the house.
Yeah.
And I'm past 40, as I've already admitted, so
okay.
I mean, I don't even want to tell you what maintenance I need. But, you know, that's the real problem is you can't, nothing stays the same. And government knows that, whatever level, federal, provincial, or local, and families, you know, need to be able to count on government to do their job. I mean, I'm living here in Katrina land in New Orleans, and
yeah.
One of the big lessons down here was, doggone, you need a good government.
And you're still rebuilding, aren't you?
Well, I'd like to say that. I mean, we're almost 4 years since the hurricane, and we still have a third of our population that hadn't been able to come home.
So yeah.
We still have some neighborhoods, like the Lower Ninth Ward, where the Canadian automobile workers worked with us down here to build some houses. But 90% of the housing still needs to be rebuilt.
I watch Home and Garden TV, and they fill the airwaves with shows about the building projects in New Orleans. And I wonder, you know, each one is a particular house, and I wonder, you know, how many times over is this happening? Because it seems awfully a slow way to rebuild a city.
Well, it is, and you know, we're still holding our breath with a new president, and
oh yeah,
that'll make a difference, but. Unfortunately, or fortunately, there's so many things that were undone that this president's got a long list, I'm afraid, before he gets down to dealing with some of the mistakes that were made in Katrina, too. So
most of the stimulus,
keep pushing.
Most of the stimulus money is still unspent, though, right?
Well, that's exactly right. And the irony is much of the FEMA money that has been promised in New Orleans still has never gotten here either. So if we could spend promises, we'd all be rich.
Yeah, well, I think people on fixed
income. That's not citizen wealth.
I think people on fixed incomes and minimum wage here feel much the same way. We just legislated several increases in the minimum wage in Ontario, but this doesn't do anything for people who've worked for 10 years to attain what's quickly becoming the minimum wage. And so they're watching teenagers come in and assume entry positions as they did 10 years ago and make very nearly the same money that they're making today. There seems to be some problem with the living wage. It just doesn't seem to have hit the public awareness yet. But I think as EI runs out for people, and they have more and more to rely on their wits to keep what they have, and whether it's their marriage or their home or their assets, whatever, I think they'll come to accept these as realities.
Well, and there's an exciting campaign that. Is now being waged in Ottawa around living wages, because I know Acorn Canada has been one of the leaders in that effort, along with a number of the local unions.
So that's true.
If this could be a prairie fire that starts to catch, too. I mean, that's what we saw down here. Once people see that, hey, you know, we really can do something to make it a little bit more fair and put people a little bit more out of harm's way, then, you know, if we can get it to the public, people know that's the right thing to do.
I attended a Leadership in Action workshop with Acorn just Monday in Toronto, and there were as many people from Ottawa came down for that workshop as there were from Toronto, which is extremely impressive.
Well, actually, now that you mentioned it, I saw a note on Twitter that the Ottawa people were going down, and they had a wonderful time in Hamilton.
Well, they were actually in Toronto.
Toronto, yeah. I guess Hamilton and Ottawa both joined in Toronto, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, I got it half right, half wrong, but that's the problem with Twitter, too.
Okay. So for someone who's looking for your book, you're saying that it's new. Information I have is you can get it at indiebound.org, amazon.com, barnesandnoble.com, or directly from the publisher. Do you know where it's being carried in Hamilton? Would we have it at Chapters or Indigo?
I know that it's in the process of being shipped there. So if people, now, you know, what they tell me as an author is just enough to get me off the phone. But know it's in the process of being shipped there. And I know who the Canadian distributor is a company, I think it's called Renko. But whether it's one copy or 10, I have no idea. But if people are in any of those stores and say, hey, I want to see Citizen Wealth because I want to buy a copy, they'll get it.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Yeah, let's, get some groundswell here.
All right.
Anything that gets the word out, and that's why I really appreciate you having me as a guest, Jeff.
Oh, yeah. Well, why don't we give some other web addresses here, www.bkconnection.com, or an email address, bkp.orders@aidcvt.com. I hope my listener is a Fast Writer, or mail to Barrett Kohler Publishers, K-O-E-H-L-E-R, and Barrett is B-E-R-R-E-T-T, Barrett Kohler Publishers, Box 565, Williston, Vermont. Ready for the postal code is 05495. So, yeah, there are some bookseller websites. There's a publisher website, and encouragement to go and search it out at Chapters or Indigo. It may be brand new. It's a hardcover. In the States, it's $24.95. Might be a little bit more in Canada.
Yeah, I think they're telling me it's around 30 is the list price. But
that's about right.
I don't know what it is on the Internet.
Yeah.
But I think if people follow some of what it's talking about, you'll make your money back many times over.
All right.
Okay, Jeff, thank you so much.
Appreciate your time.
Okay, I'll be listening for you.
Okay, Wade. Bye-bye. You've been listening to author and Acorn International organizer Wade Rafke talk about his new book for low and middle-income people on income security called Citizen Wealth. Now, something I'm sure Wade's seen too much of, Omar and the Howlers, Mississippi Mud.
I'm going back to Mississippi, to the land of the burning sun, back where 98 Highway Highway 51. I've been around the world and back again. Now I'm coming home, going back to the place I was born. That's where I belong. I'm going back. I'm going back. Mississippi. I'm coming back again. Prodigal son returns, and it's been so hard to cross back the bridges I have burned. Going back to Sweet Magnolia, this time I'm gonna stay. It's the place where my family built their homes, still stand strong today.
Disrespect takes some time now to review the news of the last week or two. We remind you that these are condensations of existing stories. To get the full story, you'll have to go to the media that we tell you about during the broadcast. Go Home, Joe Brand urges seniors, in The Spectator, recently by Joanna Furketich. Burlington's hospitals pressuring seniors to go home while waiting for long-term care to free up badly needed hospital beds. Staff at Joseph Brandt Memorial are wearing buttons saying Home First as part of the initiative launched that has some patients feeling bullied and nurses questioning who is going to care for the frail seniors at home. Quote, we don't have appropriate services in the community to support them, unquote, said Linda Haslam Stroud, president of the Ontario Nurses Association. I'm sure Joseph Brand is trying to meet targets, but meeting targets has to also be about making sure patients receive quality care. Patients are not just numbers. The hospital says it has no choice but to persuade seniors to wait at home for long-term care because they're taking up nearly 1 in 5 beds at the hospital. Some families say the hospital's real motive is closing up beds, not freeing them up. Joseph Brand is struggling with a $5.5 million deficit and is considering closing 18 beds by March the 31st. I think it's bullying, said one woman who didn't want to be identified because her mother is a patient at the hospital. I was feeling she was being kicked to the curb. She says her family was only offered 1 hour of provincially funded home care a day for her mother, who requires constant supervision. Her elderly dad can barely look after himself, and she and her brother both work. They're already finding it hard to make sure someone is at the hospital for every meal to help her eat. We're all stressed, she said. We're really, really tired. Says Kelly Ingram, manager of Patient Flow, it's better for seniors to wait at home anyway because they won't be exposed to hospital superbugs and can get up and around more. It allows people to be at home to take time to make difficult life decisions, Ingram says. And from the Globe and Mail, Tuesday, July 7th. Taser video can't be posted online, judge rules, by Oliver Moore in Halifax. Surveillance videos of a mentally ill man being tasered by police and dying 30 hours later in a struggle with jail guards. Images described as disturbing by a lawyer for his relatives need to be understood in context and can't be posted online, a judge ruled. The videos, which are central to an inquiry into Howard Hyde's death in a Dartmouth jail late in 2007, can be screened in court, and they will be shown fleetingly to the public as proceedings are streamed online at www.hydeinquiry.ca, with the tasering expected to be seen Tuesday, July the 7th. But they can't otherwise be displayed, Provincial Court Judge Anne Derrick decided. The ruling was a blow to family members of the 45-year-old paranoid schizophrenic. They'd wanted to be able to disseminate the video images. But whether the decision will be enough to squelch the spread of this material remains to be seen. It's difficult to put the toothpaste back in the tube, said Michael Geist, a University of Ottawa law professor who holds the Canada Research Chair in Internet and E-commerce Law. Once it's streamed, it's relatively trivial for someone to capture that stream and go ahead and post it. Professor Geist also noted, though, that courts can issue specific rulings against using material streamed online, which would be enough to prevent its appearance in law-abiding venues. A lawyer for Mr. Hyde's sister and brother-in-law said the decision means members of the public could miss key nuances in the videos. In essence, they'll be taking a picture of a picture, so there'll be some viewing of it, but the quality will not be as sharp, Kevin MacDonald said. It's difficult, you know, to view the subtleties. There are some subtleties on this video that you really have to focus on to catch. I think that will be lost. Mr. Hyde, a musician whose history of mental illness was known to the authorities, had been involved in earlier encounters with the police and reportedly was afraid of them. He was arrested after allegations of a domestic assault and taken to police headquarters. A fracas broke out there, and police tasered him twice. He was taken to hospital and then to a Dartmouth correctional facility. He died 30 hours after his arrest. His death was ruled accidental last year by Nova Scotia's chief medical officer, who blamed excited delirium due to his paranoid schizophrenia. Judge Derrick's inquiry, aimed at delving more deeply into the situation, began in February. It will not make findings of guilt. For the victims, The Ontario pathology scandal lives on. Kirk Makin, justice reporter in the Globe. 8 months after ending in a shower of praise and legislative reform, the inquiry into Ontario's forensic pathology scandal is a memory to all but the victims who have yet to hear a whisper about compensation. For many of the up to 20 individuals who were charged or convicted on erroneous evidence from disgraced pathologist Charles Smith, the pathology scandal remains very much alive. Quote, for a lot of people, it's never going to be over until they are compensated and the government has said that these people were wronged and now we are compensating them, unquote, said Louise Reynolds, who was wrongly jailed for 2 years for the murder of her daughter Sharon in 1977. I personally don't have any trust in government, Mrs. Reynolds said. It's taking so long that I am concerned there is not going to be any compensation. Sherry Sherritt Robinson, who was convicted of killing her child in 1996, said she is dumbfounded by the delay. We hear so many things, so many different things, and it affects our lives, she said. Mrs. Sherritt Robinson, who is awaiting an Ontario Court of Appeal review of her conviction, defaulted on her student loans while she was fighting her murder charge. As a result, she said she cannot get any more loans to resume her education. I have to sit here and try and make ends meet, she said. One thing I have learned, you can't trust the government on anything. An inquiry report concluded that Dr. Smith was an arrogant, unqualified pathologist whose biased, inconsistent, and unprofessional testimony precipitated a string of wrongful murder charges and convictions. Maurice Gagnon, the father of another victim, Leanne Thibault, said the province may think that by delaying, the public memory will be dimmed and they can get away with more. Mr. Gagnon, 71, said that he and his wife have waited 12 years to recoup at least some of the $237,000 in retirement savings that they plowed into defending their daughter. If they wait long enough, I'm going to die, and I'll never be able to enjoy my retirement, he said. The delay becomes inordinate. Our plans have been irreparably altered because of this, and my daughter too. Psychologically and emotionally, you never get over it. While Ms. Thibault, 35, was never charged, she lost custody of one of her children during a sustained police investigation precipitated by Dr. Smith's conclusion that her 11-month-old, Nicholas, had died from a non-accidental bump to his head. From the Star, Kyle G. Brown. Bailing out car insurers on the backs of accident victims. Under Ontario proposal, accident rehab benefits would be slashed for many who are injured. Of all the bailouts bequeathed to Canadian companies, there is one of which few people are aware. It's being considered in the recesses of Queen's Park and would come in the form of new automobile insurance legislation. The Financial Services Commission of Ontario, which regulates the auto insurance industry, conducted a comprehensive review that will affect drivers and passengers all over the province. Of FSCO's 39 recommendations, one has shocked health professionals. If implemented, car crash victims not classified as catastrophic, those most seriously injured, would see their rehabilitation benefits slashed from $100,000 to just $25,000. Such a move would leave thousands of people stranded without sufficient medical or rehabilitative care. For many, $25,000 provides sufficient coverage, but to legislate this as a cap for all non-catastrophic accident victims would be to willfully ignore the thousands of people whose needs far exceed this amount and to pretend they don't exist. Insurers insist that rising medical costs put them on the brink of financial ruin. There's just one problem with that claim. If the whole industry needs to be overhauled to account for such costs, why do a number of companies continue to make impressive profits? And medical and rehab costs have been rising for many years. Why did insurers not propose a rise in rates a long time ago? Some companies have failed to respond to these obvious market forces and are predictably sinking as a result. But by no means all. MSA Research, an analytical research firm focused on the Canadian insurance industry, lists the total income of Canadian property and casualty insurance companies in 2008 as more than $2.6 billion. That's down from previous years, but still impressive. And after a decade in which insurance industry profits rose continuously from more than $100 million in 2000 to many times that figure in 2007. But rather than weathering the economic crisis like other industries, auto insurers are asking the government to legislate them out of a downturn. From the Hamilton Spectator, Letters to the Editor. Phyllis Terry in Hamilton writes, regarding emergency room. I found a number of people complain about the state of the healthcare system in this country, but until now I'd never given it much thought. With my daughter, during a four-hour wait in St. Joseph's Hospital emergency that culminated with us leaving the hospital without even seeing a doctor, I watched as a teenager was left to lie on the floor while vomiting beside a garbage can. I watched as patients were shuffled from waiting room to hallway. I even watched as a staff member went to look for the doctor who was to see my daughter, but then never returned. For a few moments, I forgot I was in a developed Western nation. Amidst the 142nd celebration of our country and all the great things found within it, I think it's time we ask ourselves, is our healthcare system one of those things? Is it really something we want to hold up to the rest of the world as a symbol of the way things ought to be? And again, from the Spectator on July the 3rd, lawyers join legal aid boycott. By Barbara Brown. Hamilton criminal lawyers have joined the Ontario legal aid boycott that began last month in Toronto and has spread to Steeltown, Kingston, and Thunder Bay. Members of the local Criminal Lawyers Association say they are tired of waiting for Ontario Attorney General Chris Bentley to prop up the cash-starved legal aid plan and address inequities in the criminal justice system. We took this step reluctantly, said Robert Gee, past president of the Hamilton Criminal Lawyers Association. The Hamilton area has been hard hit by the recession. Just Wednesday, National Steel Car announced 600 layoffs. The newly unemployed and the middle class depend on a program that can't meet the demands on it. Gee said the province has poured a lot of money into policing and prosecuting guns and gangs cases in the past decade, while on the other side of the justice scales, government-funded legal aid lawyers have seen their pay eroded by inflation and stagnant funding. 40 lawyers from Hamilton who handle 100% of the local criminal cases say they will no longer accept legal aid certificates for serious cases such as homicides and prosecutions under guns and gangs legislation. Quote, Ontario has a two-tier legal system, and we want the public to know that. You need to fund social programs in tough times, or they fail their promise, Gee said. And on the same subject from the Globe and Mail, the same day, legal aid boycott gathering strength. By Kirk Macon, Justice Reporter. Defense lawyers in two more Ontario centers and an organization that picks up the pieces after a miscarriage of justice, the Association in Defense of the Wrongly Convicted, have joined a spreading legal aid boycott. The addition of several dozen lawyers in Hamilton, Sudbury, and Barrie means that the boycott now covers a substantial portion of the province. Almost every defense lawyer with 5 years of experience in Toronto, Kingston, and Thunder Bay had earlier agreed to boycott legal aid cases that involve homicide or guns and gang laws. Robert Gee said yesterday that the city's 40 defense lawyers joined in reluctantly, given that the region has been so hard hit by the recession. By launching the boycott last month, the Criminal Lawyers Association said that the province would make a net saving were it to fund legal aid properly, since experienced lawyers shorten trials by negotiating pragmatic plea bargains, conceding hopeless evidentiary points, and streamlining the trial process. The Association in Defense of the Wrongly Convicted director, James Lockyer, said that there is a direct link between poor trial counsel, underpaid expert witnesses, and wrongful convictions. He criticized appellate judges for making it almost impossible to overturn convictions where an inexperienced trial lawyer hurt his client's interests. You read trial transcripts and sometimes you just go, oh my God, Mr. Lockyer said, but the Ontario Court of Appeal has such a high threshold for demonstrating ineffective assistance of counsel that you do everything you can to avoid alleging it. If appellate judges make it easier to win new trials based on ineffective counsel, Mr. Lockyer predicted, the province would respond swiftly with higher legal aid fees in order to attract experienced lawyers back into the courtroom. Quote, it costs money, but it avoids years of legal wreckage and misery for the wrongly convicted, he said. If the government doesn't listen to what judges and lawyers are telling them, we are going to be cleaning up the mess for the next 2 decades. And again, Kirk Macon, Justice Reporter, The Globe and Mail. Plaintiff wins chronic pain case. 10 years after a hospital bed collapsed and dumped her on the floor, a Mississauga, Ontario woman has won a record-setting $3.5 million damages award for suffering chronic pain syndrome. The 40-year-old plaintiff, Diane DeGennaro, has lived with excruciating pain since May 19, 1999, when a hospital cot collapsed under her as she sat down beside her sick 2-year-old son. From that moment, Mrs. DeGennaro's life changed forever. She could no longer sit or stand comfortably, play sports, interact with her children, or have intimate relations with her husband. Quote, at the very least, the hospital was obliged to warn Mrs. DeGennaro that the bed would likely collapse if pressure was applied to one end of it, as indeed it did, end quote. Ontario Superior Court Judge Douglas K. Gray said in his ruling, the hospital did not do so. Judge Gray rejected his theory that chronic pain syndrome is a fictional malady. Its existence is discerned almost exclusively from subjective descriptions by the injured party. However, the pain is real. The judgment means that Oakville-Trafalgar Hospital and Halton Healthcare Services must pay Ms. DeGennaro $1.1 million for loss of income and $1.6 million for future costs. Judge Gray also awarded her husband and 2 sons $115,000 for loss of guidance, care, and companionship. The total also included awards for expenses and prejudgment interest. Alfred Quinter, a lawyer for Ms. DeGennaro, said he is unaware of any higher award in Canada for a chronic pain case. And last, again from the Spectator, HSR called out on stops by Ken Peters. The head of Hamilton Transit says it is unreasonable to train all city bus drivers to call out 20,000 stops for bus passengers as an interim measure for a month. The Ontario Human Rights Commission obviously disagrees. The commission this week filed complaints against Hamilton, Sudbury, and Thunder Bay for failure to call out stops for bus passengers. The commission is asking the Human Rights Tribunal to order the municipalities to begin calling out stops on all routes within 30 days. Hamilton expects to have a new $3 million fully automated call-out system in place on all buses by September. Hamilton Transit Director Don Hull was surprised Steeltown was included in the complaint. Hamilton has been working full out to get its new system in place. For us to put 400 operators through training to do manual call-outs, for us it's an issue of reliability. For us, the manual system simply will not be reliable. We're making 20,000 stops a day. It's like a bylaw that you can't enforce because you can't be there. The only thing that is going to be close to 100% reliable is a fully automated system. We're going to work with the commission and we're optimistic we'll get something sorted out. Now, pianist Scott Cushney, This Old Train. You can now listen to the show wherever you're near the internet. Disrespect is streamed live at http://cfmu.msumcmaster.ca. You can email us at dialogue, D-I-A-L-O-G-U-E, at radio.fm. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at Showtime, Thursdays at noon, 93.3 FM, CFMU, to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.